With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head to head to see which one does it better. So, on the last episode, we got the Chilly Willies in Antarctica with Kurt Russell and the boys in John Carpenter's The Thing. And so, on this episode 39, part 2, we meet the challenger taking on that slice of sci-fi horror. In the blue corner, coming in at a whopping 2 hours and 47 minutes, unless you're talking about the 4-part Netflix version, which comes in at a buttock-numbing 3.5 hours, it's Tarantino's 8th film. We're talking about The Hateful Eight. So, who is going to emerge victorious? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clash Podders. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilly.
So, as you just heard, the last movie we covered was The Thing. On this episode, going up against it is The Hateful Eight. A quick recap then. Chris, these were your choices. What connects these two movies?
It is, if it's snowing and you see Kurt Russell, run!
So that is the connection between The Hateful Eight and The Thing. You gave The Hateful Eight to Victoria. Victoria, over to you.
Right, I'm really excited about this. Chris, I've done this as an homage to you, like the style that you have taken on as your own throughout the course of this podcast. Are you ready? But I'm not going to sing because I don't have your unbelievable confidence. But anyway, bear with me. You ready? Be nice there. I had other terrible things I could have said, but no. Right, you ready? You ready? You ready? Okay, bear with. Sometimes it's hard to be a woman, giving all your hand to just one hangman. You'll have bad times, and he'll also have bad times, doing things that you don't like one bit, such as constantly smashing your face in. But stand by your hangman, give him one arm to cling to and some warm stew to chuck at you when that cabin is cold and lonely, because after all, he's just a hangman. What do you think? That's nice,
that's
isn't it?
Nice. Yeah, yeah. No,
it was about as good as when Chris does it.
Oh, thank you.
Except I'm going to be much more encouraging and you'd be much nicer than you are when I do it.
Just much nicer, generally.
Yeah. New rule. We're not reversioning songs anymore as an introduction. I'm just sort of, I'm putting the kibosh on that from here on in.
You're jealous because you've never done it and you don't know how satisfying it can be.
Do you know why I've never done it? Because I've heard them done. So
shit.
It just never works. It probably might work written down, but it's just never worked. So both of you, Just do better things in future.
Oh, I didn't realise that we were taking notes, but nonetheless.
This here is Daisy Domergue. She's wanted dead or alive for murder. When that sun comes out, I'm taking this woman to hang. Is there anybody here committed to stopping me from doing that?
well, looks like Minnie's haberdashery is about to get cozy for the next few days.
Yes, it does.
One of them fellas is not what he says he is.
Move a little strange, you're gonna get a bullet. Not a warning, not a question. A bullet.
Now we're talking!
So, The Hateful Eight, would you like to tell me about the first time you saw this extremely long film?
Yeah, I saw. I think the super long version. I don't know about you, Alex. I saw the preview in London for it for the press at the Odeon Leicester Square, the roadshow presentation, which had an overture, which had an interval. I think it might have had an extra scene or two. So yeah. I saw quite an epic version of it, which was.
And how was it? How was it watching being in the cinema for that long? I mean, obviously, you were blessed with an interval, but. Was it acceptable to sit in a cinema seat? And also, was it a comfy cinema seat?
Yeah. Yeah, it was super exciting. It was fine. I mean, you know, I saw Dance with Wolves. I've seen Avatar. You know, you watched long films in the cinema. Although I think Dance with Wolves had an interval as well back in the day.
It did. Yeah, back in the day.
But no, I really enjoyed it. And the interval...
Were you on an end seat, though? What... Did you have an aisle seat? Because like,
my legs aren't as long as yours, Alex.
I was going to say you've got really long legs, and Chris doesn't.
It's not the size of my legs; it's the size of a bladder, a sort of human bladder. I'm more interested in. Do you not get a kind of a social anxiety when you have to squeeze past people to use the lavatory? And if you do, do you not find your entire cinema experience is based on not filling up your bladder beforehand? So
no,
you don't
I like
have to
it.
Live through that horror.
I like squeezing past people, getting right up in their face, pressing myself against them. Anything for human contact. I enjoy it.
Also, the point That's was, Alex, the version I saw of it had an interval and therefore it was less than the length of a movie before you could nip to the loo. So, and the interval where it was placed and... the fact that you could then go and have a chat about what you'd just seen and what was about to happen, potentially, actually really improved the experience for me. I really enjoyed that aspect of it. So I had a fantastic first viewing of this. How about you, Al?
I never saw this at the cinema. The first time I watched this, I was I just had my wisdom teeth out and I was on quite a lot of painkillers. And I decided to watch this movie. And the painkillers weren't really working, but they had told me that I wasn't allowed to drink alcohol with the painkillers, which was annoying. So I drank half a bottle of whiskey, and I had the best time. I thought I was trapped in Millie's haberdashery. I was so off my head. But I do remember, which I'm sure we'll talk about, I remember being like, oh, my God, this is amazing. I'm there. This is so cool. And then by the end, I was like, wait, did I miss something? Why is that the end? How's that the end? I've invested 3 hours in your bloody movie, Tarantino. Do better than that at the end.
Well, quite right. I put off watching it for ages when it first came out because someone told me I wouldn't like it in a very well-meaning way. They're like, you just, you know, what happens to the woman, you won't like it. And that was enough for me to sort of flick past it. Just like, oh, I can't engage with that. But then I finally got round to it and I was fine. I was like, oh, I don't know why they were worried. I don't think that the violence is too skewed towards Daisy Domergue as played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. It was fine by me. It was fine. And then I watched it again in the week and I did feel more squeamish about it this time and I did feel a bit weird about it. But I suppose we can get onto that. This film had a bit of a bumpy start. So the script, one of the versions of Quentin Tarantino's script was leaked via Gawker, I think in around 2013. And he went bonkers about that and sued them and said, I'm not making it anymore because you've ruined everything. But that he changed his mind and did another draft and had an actor's read through. And then it was back. Although he has said, Quentin Tarantino said that what's on screen isn't anything like the read through, and he went through quite a few versions and there's quite a few different endings and all the rest of it until you get to the film that we have. So I don't know if you want to talk about, I mean, it takes a while to get going, but obviously what we're looking at is a sort of contained thriller slash mystery, sort of verging into horror, at Minnie's Haberdashery, which is a staging post in the Wyoming mountains to provide weary travellers with somewhere to rest when they're crossing the mountain. And we've got a group of eight, the Hateful Eight, who are trapped there during a blizzard. And the main thrust of it is people aren't who they say they are. And Daisy is on her way to the Hangman, and we believe, the audience believe, that she isn't going to go quietly. So potentially someone's there to bust her out of Minnie's Haberdashery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. I was trying to work out. I can't remember whether it was ever revealed who leaked the script.
I don't think so. No, because a few of the actors that had the copy, they're in the film. So he presumably, Quentin Tarantino doesn't think it was any of them.
I remember, and this isn't me saying he did it, but I remember at the time, weren't a few people talking about it being Michael Madsen who leaked it. Like, I think they said that only a few people had it, like Bruce Dern and Tim Roth and Michael Madsen and all had the
script. I thought it was Christoph Waltz.
He's not in it.
Yeah, he was potentially going to play the Tim Roth character, I think. And I thought someone said it was his agent. I'm worried that we're pointing the finger here and we're going to get sued.
No, certainly, that's why I said I'm not saying it was him, but it was reported at the time, because Michael Madsen did say to Quentin Tarantino, people are saying it's me, you need to say something in public. And I think Quentin Tarantino was like, I know it's not you.
Yeah.
It was talked about. We're not in trouble by saying it was talked about at the time that Michael Madsen did sort of have a conversation with Tarantino going, look, tell them it wasn't me, because everyone's going, it's bloody me. But if you're worried, Chris, lawyer up.
And I suppose I will throw this over to you, Chris, because it's probably more your sort of thing. Do you want to talk about the 70 mil film and all the rest of it and the lenses? I don't. The lenses that were used and how the Weinstein Company had to come up with like $10 million to be able to retrofit theatres to be able to show the fucking film in the first place all the rest of it.
What if I might want to talk about that.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry. Please do.
I don't, but I might do. Just ask in future.
You're so bossy today. What's wrong with you?
I too find it very boring, but we should in a couple of sentences just say what they did do. So it was shot in ultra Panavision, which sort of is anamorphic but retains the depth that you want. And there was only 10 films ever made in that way. So this was the 11th film. And they had to use the old cameras and lenses, and they had to make special new magazines so Tarantino could shoot his ultra long takes. I do think it makes a difference when you're watching the film, because obviously you're only getting the real benefit early on when you're seeing the snowy vistas. But later in the film, it does enable Tarantino to be able to tell stories in the foreground and the background.
Really
artfully. And so it does actually make a difference, because you've almost got, especially when you watch it the second time, you've got two films going on, haven't you?
Yeah.
You've got what you're seeing, but you've got what the business that's going on in the background. So I think that's the other interesting aspect about that.
He said it helped him with the blocking of the scenes, because the film picks up so much detail. It's a more rich scene, because you can clearly see who's, the difference between the background and the foreground and where the characters are at every point. And that helps when you're trying to create a sense of mystery. A sort of geeky fact, which I liked, is that because of they're using these ancient lenses, they didn't have a zoom lens. And obviously he's really well known for like that Hong Kong zoom, the sort of like the rush zoom. So in order to zoom, they just did it on a crane. So rather than like having a special lens, he was just flinging people around the place to create that effect, the zoom effect. That's a fun fact, no?
Yeah,
I thought so. Yeah, there you go. That's me trying really hard there.
Before we get really into it, we should just briefly touch upon what the influences were, because obviously Tarantino wears his influences on his sleeve.
They are the thing. Is that right?
He said that there's three specific films that are a bit of an influence. That's Key Largo, The Petrified Forest, and The Iceman Cometh, because they're all about bars or places that everyone congregates at and you're not sure who you can trust. They're all really great stories in their own right. So if you haven't seen them, I recommend them. But yeah, as you say, it's actually two things he said. Vicky, it was The Thing, and the other big influence on it was Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. When you get to a point in your career where you're referencing yourself, then I think you've done all right.
But that's the thing, isn't it? But that's because, well, we'll get on to the end, but I think that's because you do have a Reservoir Dogs vibe in it, and the end of that is so explosive, like emotionally, and the reveal, and this doesn't have that. And I think maybe that's why I was left ever so slightly miffed by the final reel.
Yeah, I think the easiest way to go through it would be to pick apart the characters of the key players. We've got John Ruth, played by Kurt Russell. I would say at first he's the anchor of this story, and he's the hangman taking Daisy to meet her end, and he's waylaid at Minnie's because of the blizzard. I think he's a brilliant character and really interesting because you're with him, because as an actor he's got so much pull, and you want to hear every word that comes out of his mouth, but he's a hangman and he cannot stop hitting Daisy in the face. So are you supposed to like him or not? Which is a more interesting way to watch the film.
Yeah, that's kind of a trick they play on you almost, isn't it? I feel like that you take it for granted he's going to be the hero.
Yeah.
And then as the film goes on, you're having to question your own decision for being in his corner. Based on the things he says and does. I watched this week, there's a documentary came out at the end of last year called The First Date, all about Quentin Tarantino, featuring a lot of people that work with him. And one of his producers, they asked the question, is Kurt Russell's character, John Ruth, based on Harvey Weinstein?
No.
And the woman doesn't deny it, actually. She kind of smiles. And then she just says, what I will say is he was much nastier on the page. And that when you've got a guy like Kurt Russell playing him, he immediately becomes more likable. Mm. So, yeah, that was quite surprising.
That is interesting. When she's, what do you take from that? When she said, when you've got Kurt Russell playing him, he becomes more likable, like almost intentionally they played the character more likable, or it was done as written and he just has a natural likability. Did they soften him?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know because I've not read the script, but
I mean it as a discussion point. Although sometimes I do look to you for answers, Chris.
You do. You put me on the spot.
It's just an interesting one because I agree with Vicky. You are forced to question, how this character is sort of your hero, or even as an anti-hero. He's there's so much wrong that he does by, you know, morally, that you're sort of left going, right, why? But when he does cark it, you are left with a big hole in this film, I think. I do remember watching it the first time in my painkiller whiskey haze going, oh, I should say right now, don't drink whiskey and do painkillers, kids. But it was very fun. I just remember thinking, like, oh, this is going to suck now he's gone.
Why isn't then Major Marquis Warren, played by Samuel L. Jackson, why isn't he the moral centre and the hero? Because he's, you know, he's introduced mere minutes after John Ruth, and he lasts the whole movie. And in some ways, he is the hero of the story.
Yeah, but I think
that's... It's a great question.
No, it is a really good question, and it's an interesting dynamic between the two of them, sort of plays with like expectations of their characters. So the Lincoln letter is the thing. So John Ruth asks Major Marquis Warren, as played by Samuel L. Jackson, to show him his Lincoln letter, ostensibly a letter from President Lincoln saying how amazing the Major is and what a great soldier and what a great guy and all the rest of it. And John, the look on Kurt Russell's face when he's reading this letter, like, he's teary and he's so moved.
I love it. His boyish joy, his excitement.
But then when he finds out that the letter is a fake, he says to Samuel L. Jackson, oh, it's true what they say about you people. You can't trust a word that comes out of your mouth. And that's the pivot. That's the foundation of their two sort of interaction, is that John Ruth is a racist. And the minute this black person that he knows does something wrong, he represents all black people. You can't trust anything that any of them say because this person is a liar. But what's more interesting is to have Samuel L. Jackson is not a perfect person, because why does he have to be perfect? He can be a black man in the world and not be perfect. And he should still have the same rights and entitlement as a white man in the world, John Ruth, who's not perfect. So if you make Samuel L. Jackson too good, like too objectively good, then you fall into the trap of like making him perfect. Whereas a more interesting character is he's a man, and it doesn't matter, or it shouldn't matter to you whether he's white or black. He doesn't have to do certain things in order to not catch too much blame or be a hero for too many people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. And it's a brilliant conceit, that Lincoln letter. As he puts it, the only time black folk is safe is when white folks is disarmed. I think it's the best conceit in this film, of which there are quite a few. But no, I agree. It is interesting where your sympathies lie throughout the film, because ultimately, you know, the title's the giveaway. They are the Hateful Eight. These are all pretty despicable people. To the point that actually you forget what nice people are like until that scene where Minnie and everyone show up. And you're like, oh no, this is what normal, this is how normal people behave. Because you've forgotten because you've had 2 hours of this absolute bunch of bastards.
What's the woman called? That scene with Minnie, and Minnie is lovely. She said, come on in, have some coffee, best coffee in Wyatt, whatever. But the Australian woman, I can't remember her name, but she plays
Zoe
it like
Bell's the actress.
So yeah, she plays it presumably on purpose. It's not just the relief at seeing someone normal, but she plays it like a little girl. And I found it annoying the first time. I still found it annoying again. Like, why is she so cheery? Why is she so innocent? Why is she so naive? Like, more so than a normal person.
I did wonder that. Are they being more nice than normal people are, or is it just because I've spent all this time with these horrible people? Did, and you're saying it's the former. So yeah, maybe they are being weirdly, objectionably nice. Bring me back to these hateful bastards.
Yeah,
honestly, though, that's how I feel. So I'm just like, I would rather deal with someone who is just awful than someone who is over the top nice, because that requires you to engage with them. If someone's being awful, you can shut down and just sort of go, oh, they're awful, I'm not going to interact with them. But when someone's being nice, you become the rude one by going, I don't want to interact with you.
Are they being in that way that servers in restaurants in LA are nice?
Exactly. Like, you know,
fuck off.
But, well, you say that, but this is the big question. It's like the whole service culture thing out there. It's like they're being nice because they survive on tips, so ultimately you get a nicer experience, but it's not genuine, it's false nice. So do you want someone who basically throws a cup of coffee down in front of you in the UK and goes, get the fucking drink it and get out, you dick, in so many words? Or do you want someone who goes, oh my God, look at this coffee I'm just giving you. Oh my God, you're going to have the best time here. My name's Angie, and if you want me to stroke your hair as you drink that, I can do that.
Not that kind
Vicky,
of restaurant.
Don't you think it's weird that Alex would just go to someone? Have people stroked your hair in restaurants, Alex? I bet they have. That was way too specific.
No comment, officer.
How is your hair, by the way, in this time of lockdown? Is it okay?
Oh, thanks for asking. I was waiting for that to come up. Yeah, it's doing really well. I've sort of got a new regime going on, and now I realise that you didn't really care. So I'm probably going to stop answering that question.
I cared a little bit, actually. I'm interested. Yeah. Anyone's tips, hair tips, how to get through lockdown tips, pass them on. What I'm really asking is it possible to do a half head of highlights just using the contents of a medicine cabinet? I don't think it is, but I'd like to know. Because that's where tweet, I am right now.
Tweet us at ClashPod and let us know. My tip is what I'm about to do in the next couple of weeks. Shave it all off. Shave your head of hair off.
Me?
Wait. You're going to have a shaved head but a massive beard.
Yeah, I'm going to do an Uncle Albert is what it's called.
don't.
I look like my head's on upside down.
Do it. You're going to look like an extra from Mad Max or something. It's going to be great.
No, I look more like Oscar Isaac in Ex Machina. That's the look.
Yeah, definitely.
100%.
Right. 100%.
Anyway, back to the Hateful Eight. Sorry.
So let's talk about Daisy, because Quentin Tarantino himself, so it's not just me, has said that she's at the heart of the story, because she's in, you know, the opening sequence, and you don't understand what her situation is. You know that she's being hanged for murder, but you get the sense that there might be a little bit more behind that. And she might be guilty, but, you know, why is she in this situation and what is she going to do about it? So she provides the engine for the mystery the minute John Ruth states it clearly and says, one of you is here to free Daisy or something like that, and I'm going to find out who. Now, unfortunately, he dies fairly soon after that, but it's like the game is afoot formally. Like, you understand that you're in a mystery, like, fairly sharpish, but at least it's been, we've got the Poirot, Agatha Christie moment of, like, we're all trapped in here and something's going to happen and I'm going to find out who it is. However, we can talk about this at length or we can skip over it, but it's just... Quentin Tarantino said he wrote quite a few drafts to try and get to know Daisy a bit better, because she dies at the end, and he didn't feel right about killing her until he knew her a bit better, which is very understandable and quite a noble thing to do.
But, wow. I mean, he wouldn't make a very good assassin, would he, though? Quentin Tarantino's spending a lot of time with you at the moment. Yeah, he said he wanted to get to know me. Yeah.
But I think the problem is, he might know her back to front and inside out and feel able to have her hanged at the end in a very gruesome way, but we don't know her. And it seems unfair that lots of other characters get a really interesting backstory. So think of Samuel L. Jackson's character's backstory about him crossing the lines in the Civil War, but he wasn't welcome on either side. A really complicated story, not just good, not just bad, like a mix of both. And think about the way that John Ruth is played. You're kind of rooting for him, but he's an awful person. And Chris Mannix, like, he seems like a terrible liar and a live wire, but by the end of the film, he's the moral center. So, and you have the whole flashback where you've got the chapter 4 or 5 or whatever it is about the four passengers. So we get time with those actors to see what they can do. But Daisy doesn't get anything like that. And she doesn't, it would have been so much fun to have a flashback that showed why she got caught for murder. Do you not think?
Yeah, I mean, he said that he wrote this in a different way, just touching on what you said, to previous scripts. He normally spends a couple of years writing the first draft from beginning to end. And at the end of the process, he feels like he's there. Whereas this is the first time he's done separate drafts. He's done proper rewrites like normal people do.
Yeah, I was going to say.
He did say that one of his rewrites, as you said, it was one specific rewrite because he felt guilty about the violence that was done to Daisy. He wrote a single draft that was completely from her point of view so that he understood the emotions she was going through. Once he got to the end of that draft, he felt no remorse in hanging her, beating her up and hanging her.
Sure.
And you're right. You're absolutely right. Why keep that to yourself then? I'm sure he shared it with Jennifer Jason Leigh, but I think that's a really good point you make.
Yeah. It just is. She's such a good actor. It's just a shame that we don't get to see her. And I don't think he's saying this on purpose, but it's too tempting to think her whole character is that she's a woman and a murderer. And that in itself is shocking enough that you don't need to know her story because that's enough character. But I don't think it is. Like, I would like to know why. I would like to know when. Why has she got such a good relationship with her brother that he would come and get her? Why is her life gone the way it's gone, that she's in a gang rather than anything else? I don't think it's enough just to go, oh, yeah, but she's a woman, so that's, like, kind of interesting, and that's enough.
She is a very good actor, though. There's that brilliant scene where she breaks character, though. You know, the bit where Kurt Russell smashes the guitar and you actually see her go, oh, fuck, because he thought it was a prop guitar and it was 145 years old on loan from a museum. But I've just watched it so many times because you see her go, no, don't fucking do that. And he's like, smash, 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 I'm Kurt Russell.
As John Ruth puts it, she's peppery.
She is peppery. Which she is gets such a brilliant line.
She gets a couple of moments where she licks the blood from her lips and her face and smiles, and she just looks brilliant, devilish, sort of laughing maniacally, spitting out teeth. It must have been a joy to play that character.
Yeah, she reminds me a little bit of the Joker in The Dark Knight in that respect, in the sense that she takes so much glee in, like, the chaos that is happening around her. She almost, like, sort of sets it off and then sits back and watches it take place.
Good comparison.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
I've read this somewhere else, but I also thought it by myself, which is why I'm saying it. She looks like Carrie, like for a lot of the film. That's quite distracting.
It sounds like you stole that from somewhere.
No, yeah, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't steal it because I said I read it. I did think it, and then I thought, oh,
but did you think it after you'd read it?
No comment, Alex. someone's poisoned the coffee and we're going to find out who. And is it Signor Bob or Oswaldo something, as played by Tim Roth?
Mowbray. Oswaldo Mowbray.
The cowboy.
That was a fun reveal with Oswaldo.
What about his accent?
Yeah, because I remember getting really annoyed in the cinema that he was doing such a shit posh accent. And then so the reveal that he was putting it on, the character was, I was very happy with that.
Yeah, it's a relief, isn't it? You just, oh, thank God.
Tim Roth's not this bad an actor. Oh, no. He's supposed to be doing a slightly shit accent.
And then Samuel Jackson is doing, because John Ruth, Kurt Russell is dead, the mantle passes to Samuel L. Jackson to be Poirot and to try and sort out what's happened. But Channing Tatum is hiding under the floorboards and then shoots his bollocks off. So he's laid low. And then we're into Reservoir Dogs, I think.
Yeah. Does he really shoot? I mean, I know he keeps saying he says his nuts shot off, but is he just taking a bullet to them, or have they been shot clean off? I know that shouldn't bother me as much as it does, but I'd like to know.
Are they that big that if a bullet went through them, they wouldn't come off? Is that what you're saying?
They vary in size, Victoria. I don't know how big specifically Samuel L. Jackson's bollocks are, or whether he changed the size of them for the role.
Like a wig. Just slotted.
Hey, Quentin. Quentin, I've really got to grips with my character. The one question I still have is, how big are his bollocks? Because that's the last thing I'm going to be working on just before the shoot.
Yeah, I'm heading into makeup now, so it's kind of like...
He's getting on a bit now, isn't he, Sam Jackson? So I imagine they're hanging
if
quite
this
low.
Is no! Oh God, I knew it was gonna. I didn't want to get into old men's bollocks.
Like hanging low, like a rabbit's ears.
Like a rabbit's ears? You mean like two walnuts in a carrier bag?
Well, won't they be getting smaller? Do they get smaller when you get older? So maybe more like peanuts in a sock.
Peanuts in a pop sock, like a thin sock. I said pop sock for a while. That's weird.
The bag gets bigger, not bitter, although it can be. It depends. Oh, I mean, they've been out in the wilds for a long time. I'm sure it's quite bitter if you were to sample it. But the bag gets bigger, but the actual ball area decreases in size. So yeah. I think there's a good chance that the bullet passed straight through the sack without hitting the ball.
Well, I tell you who would know, just to, you'll like this segue, is, I've forgotten his name, the general's son, who Samuel L. Jackson's character has a strange sort of 10 minutes where he convinces the general that he's killed his son, but prior to killing him, he made him perform oral sex for him in order to warm his mouth. You like that segue? That works, doesn't it? Bringing it all back. Yeah.
Wait, I've forgotten. But I remember that scene. But he did it to warm the other guy's mouth.
No, that's what he says to him. He says, "You'll be surprised what some people will do to get warm." And he's promised him a blanket. Wait. I understand where this is.
I understand now, because if he does that, he gets a blanket.
No, but also he says
warmth does not like. Disperse from a penis if you put it inside your mouth.
How would you know? In fact, of all of us, why should you should be asking me, is that true, Vicky? Yeah, it is actually.
Oh no.
I really want to move on.
Reverse. I'm going to pump the brakes and reverse, please.
Okay, never mind. Shit.
In that scene, though, I like the various words he uses for his penis. He calls it his pecker, his Johnson, and his dingus.
Dingus. That's a good one. I haven't heard that for ages.
That's General Sandy Smithers is the son.
Thank you.
Obviously this scene is very similar to the scene in True Romance between Dennis Hopper and Christopher Walken. Mm. In that film, Hopper's character is telling a racist story so that Walken will kill him quicker and not torture him for information. And in this one, he's doing it so that the dad will take the gun and it will either can therefore kill him in self-defense. But I feel like it is, again, you know, he said that this is a film that's in homage to Reservoir Dogs, but it's actually, you know, it takes pieces from a lot of his back catalogue as it goes along. And I think this is probably the most obvious one.
Yes, I agree. And is this an obvious thing to say? But I sort of missed it the first time round and only noticed it properly second time round. But he is lying, isn't he? He never killed him. He didn't. Everything he says is a lie, isn't? Do you think?
No, I didn't get that from it.
Well, but only because he says your son. The general is talking about buying a peach orchard with his money and his wife and all the rest of it. And then Samuel L. Jackson says, oh, I knew a boy who talks about a peach orchard or something like that. And he says, in fact, he told me his whole life story, but he doesn't corroborate any further than that. So he doesn't provide any evidence that says, oh, it definitely was your boy because of this. He just runs with the peach thing, but he doesn't say anything else. So I thought he was lying because he wants to kill him anyway because he's a racist piece of shit. But he doesn't offer up any other proof that he did know that boy. No?
Yeah, no, that's true. I hadn't thought of that.
And I think he's lying. It's so specific and extreme. It is just completely designed to make that man pick up the gun. And so I do think it's made up in the way that, you know, this film and a lot of Tarantino's films are about storytelling and myths and legends and lies and truth. But, you know, I don't think that makes it any less effective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so where were we? We were sort of lingering around the end. And then there's I lose the thread a bit, but Chris Mannix, Samuel Jackson has had his nut shut off and he's going to die. He's going to bleed to death, we think. But Chris Mannix, the would-be sheriff of Red Rock, he seems to be okay. He's been shot in the leg and it sort of seems like he might make it. So he's making deals with Daisy, having she's got her brother's skull all over her face, but she's going to make a deal saying that there are 15 members of her brother's gang waiting in the town, and that if Chris Mannix doesn't make a deal, everyone in that town will be killed. And so what a shit sheriff he will be. So there's a series of trade-offs of people's bodies. But then basically everyone dies and Chris Mannix and Major Marcus Warren hang Daisy from the rafters, and that's kind of it.
Yeah. Did you ever try Red Rock Lager, by the way? Now, I kept thinking of it when I was watching this.
Is that the one in a green can or a green bottle?
It was the one that years ago Leslie Nielsen used to advertise from Police Squad. He played Frank Drebin in the adverts, and he goes, "Red Rock. It's not red, and there are no rocks in it."
I don't think I did.
Okay. Sorry,
that,
go on.
That ending you referenced, though, and it is the same ending as The Thing, isn't it? You've got a black guy and a white guy sitting together, potentially about to die or stay alive. It's similar. It's up to you to decide whether they make it or not. And I do like that. I think it's almost weird how much he is paying tribute to The Thing in a different genre and a different style. But he really does. You know, you talked about those, Alex, when you were coming up with them, the sticks in the snow to get to an outhouse. Like, that's definitely, right. You know, that's very much on purpose, isn't it? It almost seems unnecessary to put that in.
No,
I think so. And if we think about, you know, when we talked about The Thing on the last episode, and part of our problem, or well, not our problem, but we were sort of saying that, you know, there should have been a bit more character development. There should have been more people talking in rooms. We'd have liked to get to know these characters more. I honestly think if you had pitched The Thing as not necessarily one room like Millie's Haberdashery, but, you know, everyone was inside a lot more. You didn't need to be going outside too much. And it was guys trying to work things out about each other and which one was the alien through conversation. Then I think that would have been possibly a much better film. And I say that liking The Thing.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, you could potentially see, though, both of these films, obviously you'd have to do some interesting stuff with the effects, but both of them would work as plays, potentially.
Yeah, they would.
I didn't know that Quentin Tarantino actually had started this as a novel. I think he initially started writing this as a novel. When you watch it, it feels... I honestly watch this and I feel like I'm reading... It's like the script is like a novel, like you're watching a novel.
Well, he was definitely going to go in that direction when the script leaked. He sort of said in a huff, "I'm doing it as a book rather than a film." And he said this, and certainly that documentary, I think Tim Roth or Michael Madsen allude to it, that I think once he has done that, the next film, he will start writing books rather than making movies. So he's slowly moving in that direction.
I think you're absolutely, you're fine to talk about. So I'm just on a WhatsApp a chat with my lawyer. You can talk about the script being leaked. And him thinking of writing a novel, that's fine. We're good with that, Chris. Go on.
And you said Christoph Waltz leaked it, did you, Alex?
just for clarity.
Just got my dictaphone here.
I'm going to need you to say the words, Christoph Waltz.
But in terms of like homaging his own film, some of these tense conversations where you're trying to figure out who's telling the truth and who isn't, I mean, he does that in most of his films, but certainly in Glorious Bastards, it reminded me of. and the reveal of people being under the floorboards.
That's
paying homage to himself. One thing I spotted on this watch is that at the end of this film, Tim Roth is on the floor covered in blood, and he's a bad guy pretending to be a good guy, whereas Reservoir Dogs, he's on the floor covered in blood and he's a good guy pretending to be a bad guy.
Yeah.
So, he's playing little tricks with his own work as well. Does that become annoying? Is that him sort of essentially filleting himself, or do you think that works?
I think when you're looking for those things, you spot them. I don't think they're so obvious that they detract from the film. I certainly, on my first watch, did not notice any of them. I think maybe I felt there was a vague similarity between this and Reservoir Dogs, but I certainly wasn't to the point of going, oh, he's taken that bit, oh, he's done that bit. It stands alone as a wonderful film.
So was this a second watch for you, Alex, and a first sober watch, or have you seen it more than twice?
Who's got the time, babe? Who has got the time? Like, watching it twice is a stretch. Do you not think?
Well, Alex has watched it twice. I'm just asking if he's watched it a third time.
I've not. I've only watched it. Oh, shit. No, I have. This is my third time watching it. Yeah. And I could genuinely watch it again. And that is testament to just what an amazing experience watching this film is, even though you know the ending. And even though, in my case, I don't much like the ending, I will still rewatch this because everything up to the end is so good that it actually doesn't matter that the end is not my cup of tea. That tells you what a great film it is.
But that's why it's a shame that it's not the end of the world, but everyone gets it because the dialogue is so naturalistic but full of information. So the stuff you miss first time round, you then pick up second time round. So first time I watched this, I wasn't really paying attention to Chris Mannix's character beyond whether or not he was lying about being the sheriff. So second time round, when I had time to listen to him and the thing about his dad's gang and how they, you know, the unconditional surrender, but his dad's gang was like holed up with like 400 soldiers and they didn't have a chance. That's so fascinating. And it's just a shame that I don't have that same thing for Daisy to do, because it would even things out and it just would have been brilliant anyway. Like, that's that actor, what he can do as a writer and all the potential, it would have been brilliant.
So did you believe Walton Goggins was the sheriff, Chris Mannix? Do you think he's telling the truth?
Yes.
By the end.
And was it, so did you guys have a problem with the ending then? So you were kind of alluding to it, Alex. What doesn't work for you? Because I feel like that's the ending it's building up to, but I feel like this time, it's my third watch, I'd almost lost interest by that point and I couldn't figure out why.
I just don't really know what the ending is, what you're really meant to take away from it in terms of, like, to invest 3 hours in a movie that is so clever in terms of its writing, but doesn't really seem to have anything to say at the end. There's no twist, there's no lingering, and there you go. How about that? Mm. You're just left with these two guys. I mean, there are two ways of looking at it as far as I'm concerned. It's either a sort of like, well, what did you expect? It's the Hateful Eight. They're all hateful. Wasn't that exactly what I said it was going to be? A group of awful people get their comeuppance at Millie's Haberdashery. Or perhaps it's that there is some sort of friendship, camaraderie that emerges between Chris Mannix and Major Warren by the end. They sort of, those two, sort out their differences to a certain extent and become, in inverted commas, friends.
Yeah, I feel like it's about justice, and justice does get served at the end of the film, in that the two least hateful people in the room of the eight have a chance at moving on, and Daisy gets what was coming to her from the start of the film because of the things she's done previous to the film starting. But maybe, yeah, as you say, maybe it's because you're expecting some kind of twist or to have the rug pulled out from under you, as it has done throughout the film. And it just, it's pretty straightforward, those final 10 minutes.
There you go. I think that's the word. It's not bad. It's just more straightforward than I expected.
Yeah, that's fair. Do you want to do the bits, or have you got anything else you would like to share with the group?
Nope. Ready for the bits.
Okay, super. Alex, what was your best scene?
Best scene. Can I have the entire carriage ride at the start? Because I loved it. I just, in terms of...
It's 35 minutes you've just picked.
Yeah. In terms of the fact that I just remember the first time I watched it, and I will say this, this is before the whiskey and painkillers had mixed, so I was still very much compos mentis at this point. I was just in such a shock to be watching a film. You just don't see an opening scene like that that is going to last 35 minutes. You think maybe like after sort of 10 minutes, I'm like, this is insane. I remember being just so shocked that he was running an opening like bit in the carriage for that length of time, and shocked in a way that, you know, when you get excited where cinema shocks you still and you're like, wow, it's so bold. It's nuts. This is amazing. I had that experience, and obviously, you know, Kurt Russell and Samuel L. Jackson, Jennifer Jason Leigh, the three-way interaction, then Walton Goggins turning up. It's great, and I haven't had a film sort of like blow me away so much as that start in terms of its boldness.
Vicky, what's your favourite scene?
My favourite scene is the, which I talked about before, which is the reveal that the Lincoln letter is false, because there's so much going on thematically and for the characters. And I think it's really deftly handled. And it's funny as well. And it's sad for lots of different reasons all at the same time.
Cool. I'm going to pick the 2 hours and 10 minutes after the coach ride. I'm with you. I think if I picked a moment from that sequence, it would be when she spits on the letter. Kurt Russell punches her and they both fly out of the carriage. I think that's it's just a great moment. But I'm going to go for that 10-minute speech by Samuel L. Jackson. I've got problems with it, and it is really, really horrible. But I'm picking it because it was such a memorable moment watching it in a packed cinema, all excited to see, you know, the preview of the new Tarantino film. And you could hear the audience nervously fidgeting as it got more and more unpleasant, that story. And then that was when the interval came as well in the film. And so at the interval, just talking with other people who've been watching it about what we'd just seen, it was a really memorable cinematic moment for me. So I'm picking that.
Cool.
Are you trying to say we should have perhaps taken an interval after we dissected the nutsack earlier in this podcast? Just to let people be able to walk away, step back from their headphones and go, wow. Were they trying to be more graphic than Samuel L. Jackson's speech?
What's your MVW, Vicky?
So obviously there's lots to choose from, but I would say on second viewing, it is Samuel L. Jackson as Major Warren. I thought he was majestic. And everything we've said already, which is he's a good enough guy for you to want to follow him through the narrative, but it's been avoided like making him perfect, which I really like.
Alex?
Do you know what? I started trying to work out my MVW, my voice valuable, whatever, going through the characters, because at times I think it's Chris Mannix. I think Walton Goggins as Chris Mannix is just, I mean, you know, he's a brilliant actor. And this role is like him, like, you know, just being the best. But then you sort of go, actually, I think pretty much everyone is giving one of their best performances in this because the script is so good. You know, I mean, Michael Madsen, I don't think, has ever been better. Damien Bashir as Senior Bob is so good. I think it would be unfair. At least, you know, for me, I just couldn't pick one. So the reason they're all so good is the script. So it's the script. I'm actually picking the script as my MVW. I can't believe it didn't get an Oscar nomination. That's one of those, what? Come on, the Academy. Don't be dicks about this. It's so good. And to be that gripping, set in one bloody room for 2.5 hours, is all down to that script. So it's the script. Mm.
And as scripts don't write themselves, Quentin Tarantino gets a shout out.
They do write themselves. There's a program you can get. It's called 8 People in One Room, something like that. I don't know. It's not expensive. It's fine.
Is that true?
No! You're funny.
Lovely stuff.
I'm so annoyed. Wait a minute. All right, fine. Carry on.
Well, I feel like I should mention here Ennio Morricone because we haven't properly talked about him. And it's quite interesting the fact that Tarantino wanted him to score it. He didn't have time, but he let his wife read the script. And Morricone's wife said, you have to do this. So he wrote him one piece of music, which is the main piece of music. And Tarantino says, I love this. This is perfect. I want you to, you know, have you got anything else? Like, could you do me just a quick thing, a bit like your music that you did for The Thing? And that's when he told him, well, actually, I've got a whole load of music for The Thing that Carpenter didn't want to use. You can have it. And so that's how you've got this weird sort of Frankenstein music score, which is so effective in this film. But I'll go for Jennifer Jason Leigh. I think she's really, really good in this. I really enjoy her peppery performance for the reasons I've said. And I kind of, as you say, Vicky, I wish she'd had a bit more to her character and backstory. I think she kind of earned it. So, yeah, I think it's one of her best performances. So she's my pick. And finally, Alex.
Not to try and stir the pot, but do you remember there was that weird story about Ennio Morricone calling Quentin Tarantino? He did an interview for Playboy, and apparently he was quite rude about Quentin Tarantino in it, and then said he was going to sue Playboy because he never said that. It was Playboy Germany. And it's just, I just remember it being a really weird story. Like, they quoted him as calling Quentin Tarantino's films trash and saying he calls out of nowhere and then wants to have a finished film score in days. And it was just a really weird story. I just felt it would balance out the accusations we were throwing around earlier in the script.
Piling up more accusations on someone.
Yeah. I figure it would just confuse the matter. It's like, you know, more ugly gossip. It's like, who knows what were we talking about? Did Ennio Morricone, like, did he leak the script?
That makes perfect sense. They couldn't have time in court for both issues, so just do none of them.
And I heard that Tim Roth resorted to cannibalism on this set as well. That's, I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, that's true. That's another truth. Well done, Vicky. Have you got any truths?
It's about Michael Madsen's testicles, so I don't know if we want to go into it.
Alex, what would you change, if anything?
At the end. I don't know how. And I know that's a kind of ridiculous thing to sort of just say. Because, I mean, undoubtedly, Quentin Tarantino wrote the best end for his movie, and I've already picked the script as the bloody MVP. Not to then go, yeah, the script is the best thing about this movie, apart from the end. I don't know. I feel like the journey is way better than the destination on this film, for want of a better cliche.
Vicky.
Chris Mannix never was that sheriff, and we find that out for sure. So towards the end, when he's making deals with Daisy, I can't remember what he says, but Samuel L. Jackson says something like, oh, what is it like, why do you care? Or someone says like, why? Oh, I can't even, do you know what? Edit this out. I can't remember what someone says. However, Chris Mannix has the opportunity to say, I was never the sheriff, you idiots, and I will make a deal with her because... is it really important to me? Oh, that's it. She's like, well, you care about the town? And he could say, no, because I'm not the sheriff of the town. So there we are. That's a better ending.
Can I just throw something in? Because I remember at the end of The Thing, you said how important it wasn't knowing who was the thing or not. I'm just going to say, I don't think it's important, really, whether you know, whether he is or he isn't. That's not what the end is about. It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter knowing whether he's the sheriff or not. Anyone who doesn't realise how funny I'm being, check out the end of the last podcast.
I'm laughing, so that's fine. Yeah,
it doesn't matter, though. It just doesn't matter. What are you talking about? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether we know that or not.
Fine.
Is that your impression of Vicky? Is that an impression of Vicky?
I think it is, yeah.
Because did you see, Alex, did you see we got an email about Vicky to the Clash?
Ooh!
No, you didn't.
No, I haven't looked.
We did. No, someone wrote in, Russ, and said, please discuss if anyone else thinks Vicky sounds like Jen from the IT Crowd.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm flattered.
Can't stop picturing Jen when Vicky talks.
Doubly flattered. Thanks,
but
mate.
I then looked up that woman, and she's from Hounslow.
Yeah.
And then she moved to Surbiton, and she went to a posh school, and she went to Oxford. So I don't see how she sounds like you.
I don't know what that's supposed to mean. But
well, she's not northern. She's not northern, is all I'm saying. Blimmin' heck. It's easy defensive.
There is an episode of the It Crowd where Jen like drinks about 20 blue WKDs and gets pretty abusive.
So that's when that. I sound like
could be that.
Then you can't tell us apart. Okay, fair enough. No, I'm thrilled. I'm actually thrilled.
See, I'm back to reading the emails now. So and now I'm in that account. So expect more of those. If you think Vicky sounds like anyone else, let us know.
Please don't.
Why did that sound like such a threat? I'm back to reading the emails now.
So I would change the moment of narration in this film.
I hate that. That's a good point. I fucking hate that.
Tarantino doesn't normally use narration. He uses it quite well in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood when I think it's Kurt Russell's doing the narration. But here it's his voice that comes in. And that's the first time he's done that. And I don't think it's necessary because he explains when and where and how the coffee got poisoned and who knew about it. Hmm. But you absolutely could have shown that and not said it. And I think you could have and should have shown it during that big speech. And I'm guessing he didn't want to do that because it would take away from Samuel Jackson's big moment. But this way it just feels clumsy. And that way I feel like it would have actually made that break, the interval or the break in the normal version of the film, that much more exciting. Because not only have you just heard this crazy speech and seen this violent act, but you also know that, you know, they're about to drink poison. So I feel like he did himself a disservice there.
Yeah. It does become very much like the Tim Curry movie Clue at that point.
Shout out for Tim Curry. Yay, you're back on track.
Oh, yeah. It's weak, but it's there.
And on that bombshell.
Is everyone done?
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Yes. Yeah. Let's move on to... Go on, Alex. Sorry, you do this bit, don't you?
No, it's fine. You do it. I love it when you do it. You do it.
All right. Are you ready for the verdict?
The verdict, Sam. Sorry, I thought I was doing it. Yeah, let's do the verdict.
Okay. Alex, you seem to want to speak.
Okay.
So let's have your verdict first.
I'm thrilled. My verdict is, I think these are both great films. I'm really pleased you picked them, Chris. I thought initially, I was like, okay, I guess The Connection, Isolated. No idea how many similarities there are between these two films. I think The Hateful Eight is brilliant. I think The Thing is brilliant. I'll keep it short. I'm going for the film that I love the most, quite simply, of two films that I love. I'm going for The Thing.
1 point for The Thing. Okay, Vicky, which of these two films are you going to go for?
I would also like to say I thought it was a good week, and for the same reasons as Alex, like I got it, but then they're really closely intertwined, and that's always a treat when we've got two films that have got... a sort of sibling relationship in that way.
So however, if anything, the winner this week is the person who picked the films, which is me.
I think that's what I was about to
say. Okay, join us for the next Clash of Titles.
When we
and
decide
this week's winner is Chris Chilley.
But The Thing opens masterfully, but just left me confused in the middle as to what I was supposed to be scared of or following. And it just felt a bit that the story had been sacrificed in order to show off, admittedly amazing, but special effects. And there's nothing more important to me than story. And so therefore, The Hateful Eight wins for me.
Oh, bollocks.
No, I didn't Don't pretend you don't like having the final say,
no,
Christopher.
No, I didn't want to on these two because... I think I know which direction I'm going in. A problem I had with The Thing watching it this time is having done Alien so recently, I found them very similar. And I just think Alien is a superior film where we got to know the characters a bit better. And as I said on this, the last show, I really hate the reveal at the start of The Thing. And I feel like they could have been smarter with the stuff towards the ending. But there is that... You know, there's that issue with Hateful Eight in the similarities with his previous films. I find a bit cringeworthy. But I liked all the stuff happening in the foreground and the background, and I like how it was about storytelling and myths and legends. And people complained about Hateful Eight that it was too talky, but that's what I'm here for with Tarantino films. I love hearing his words. I love spending time with his characters. I don't care about the length. I'm, you know, If we get one every 3 years, I want 3 hours of it. So I'm really worried I'm going to lose all my horror credentials here, but I'm picking The Hateful Eight.
Yay!
And I'm disappointed in myself, and I was not expecting to go in that direction. But watching them back to back, I think there are more problems. I think the thing, there's too many issues with it this time. This podcast is spoiling films for me because I'm analysing them in ways I never have done before, and it's killing me.
Well, that's good news.
Well, this was the last Clash of the Titles. Chris Tilly bows out on The Hateful Eight. We'll shut it down, Chris. I don't want you to have films ruined for you. Should we call it a day?
Yes.
Okay, great. It's been real, people. I'm glad we split our final episode into two separate episodes. Just to
weird.
Drag out the sadness. All right, then. So The Hateful Eight. Oh, that is this week's winner. It bests The Thing, much to my disappointment. But I'm not too bothered this week. I'm not going to get angry because I like both of them. So there we have it. What do you think, though? You can get in touch with us on Twitter. As usual, we are at ClashPod on Twitter. And you, as Chris said, he's back to reading emails. Take from that what you will, but you can now email us. It's show@clashpod.com. Victoria, you're picking next episode's films. We've already announced them online, but if you'd like to do the verbal confirmation, I'd be interested to know again.
I would love to. We've spent a lot of time talking about testicles. And so in that spirit, Chris, I would like you to watch The Full Monty. Da, 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 da. Alex, I would like you to watch, and you are going to have such a lovely time. God love this film. Please will you watch Magic Mike? Yes!
Whoa!
Yes,
two
yes,
movies
yes.
Where we talk about Channing Tatum and testicles. I'm in. Because we talked about testicles in the Hateful Eight.
No, that's fine.
Anyway, yeah, I'm good with that. Yeah, that's fine. It's fine. I'm good with that. I don't know why I've said that's fine so many times. I'm not nervous about my feelings towards Channing Tatum and how much I love him and how excited I am about the next, 2 hours. I'm probably going to go and watch Magic Mike right now. I love Magic Mike. Am I monologuing? I'm just a fan of the movie. Carry on. What are we saying? Channing Tatum? Who said that?
Are you finished?
I am. Yep, I am finished. In more ways than
one. Yuck. Pack it in. This lockdown, this is not good. It's like there are no consequences. There are consequences to your actions. Chris has gone quiet. He doesn't know what to think.
He's on the phone to his lawyer still about the Christoph Waltz revelation earlier. Right. Let's call it a day then. Let's just end. Thank you very much for listening. As you just heard, we are going to be doing Magic Mike and The Full Monty on our next episode. We'll be starting with The Full Monty. So if you're limited with your time, do that one first and then do Magic Mike. Please do subscribe to us and rate and review us. And, you know, the 2 R's that we rely on, that's a third R. It's on Spotify, on Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, you can do that. Thank you very much for listening, and congratulations to our winner, The Hateful Eight. We'll be back on Thursday.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.